Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. History and good leadership today on Advanced. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another Advanced Studio Classroom. Today, you are joining me and my co-host, Peter, in the studio for our June books article. It's a books article, not really a book report, but it is kind of a book report because it's about a book. We're going to be learning today about a broad subject, the subject of lessons of history. Specifically, our subtitle tells us that we're looking at how the study of history contributes to good leadership. Peter, have you read this book?
I have not read this book, Simon. Hello, everyone. It's a relatively new book, came out in September of 2025. I would put it on my list, but I haven't read it yet.
It deals with some familiar concepts, though, right? Most people who've sort of come through university will be aware of English idioms like, history repeats itself.
Yes.
Right? Or history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes.
Yes.
Have you heard that
one too?
Right?
Sure.
What's the difference between those two sayings?
Well, history repeats itself means that something that happened once in the past happens in pretty much exactly the same way again in a future generation or future time. Whereas history doesn't repeat itself, but rhymes means that something that happens in the past will happen again in the future, but in a different way in terms of the specifics, but in a way that does recall the first time it happened in the past.
Sort of connected or familiar.
Yeah. Like two words that rhyme. They're not exactly the same word with the same meaning, but they sound the same, like car and star. Two very different things, but they rhyme because they sound the same.
So there's two ideas there. They are related. They don't really agree. But together they fall into what I would call a category of like common sense or common understanding culturally, at least within Western culture, that it's important to have a familiarity with history because it influences what is going to be happening in the present and the future.
Yes.
And so that's the underlying idea here, that history has valuable lessons for people who are going to be leaders.
Yeah, and just there's another expression worth mentioning. Some people, the expression goes, the past is not dead. In fact, it's not even past.
Oh.
I forget who said that.
What does that mean, Peter?
Well, often it's easy to think, you know, there is nothing but the present moment because the past, we can't do anything about the past. We can't be in it. It's past. It's what's already happened. And the future, obviously, is what is still to come, and we can't be there either. We can only be in this present moment. So there's a way of thinking about people who are overly controlled or influenced by things that have happened in the past, either on a societal level or on a personal individual level. And so sometimes people will say, oh, you know, come on, the past is dead. You can't keep carrying around, can't keep letting it influence you that way. But some, at least one writer or person has said, the past is not dead. In fact, it's not even past, which again is just about how the past does continue.
So you're saying it continues to influence the present.
Right, right. Yeah. It's two debatable points and kind of a philosophical discussion because, sure, in one sense, the past is, you know, is dead, is no longer past, where it's just the present moment. But in another way, it does continue to influence us in the present. So you can take both positions philosophically, but that's just an expression that always stuck with me.
Yeah. There you go. Well, listeners, we're going to do two readings today in the first part of this lesson. It's a two-day lesson. We're going to start off with a reading that refers to Winston Churchill. You ready, Peter?
I'm ready.
All right, let's jump into our first reading now. I would say, listeners, if you have your Advanced magazine for the month of June, I would encourage you to open it up and read along as we have the lesson read to us. If you don't have a magazine, I would encourage you to get one because it is the easiest and most convenient way to support Advanced Radio and the things we are doing here. Let's do that reading. Let's do it now.
The Lessons of History: How the Study of History Contributes to Good Leadership. Winston Churchill, the towering British statesman who served as Prime Minister during World War II, was once asked by an American student how to become a successful leader. Churchill's advice? Study history. Study history. In history lie all the secrets of statecraft. Frank Gavin, a professor at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and the director of the university's Kissinger Center, believes Churchill was on to something. Gavin argues that studying history, fascinating in its own right, can also be exceptionally helpful to aspiring statesmen and stateswomen. Examining the past does not provide ironclad laws of human behavior or a clear blueprint for the future. However, if investigated carefully, history can help leaders better appreciate complexity, uncertainty, and ambiguity in public affairs. It teaches leaders to ask hard questions, re-examine long-held assumptions, appreciate irony, and be modest, even humble, about what they think they know.
Thank you very much, Campbell. And Peter, we're introduced to Winston Churchill. It's not really an introduction. Most of us will be familiar with this character. But it gives us sort of an introduction to who he was. It says a towering British statesman, ironically enough. I think he was not all that tall, which is usually what towering means. But here they're using it in a less literal way. You know, if somebody is towering over you, it means they're very tall compared to you. And so they're much higher than you are. But here, they're kind of saying his reputation is very tall, very
big, which is towering.
That reputation as a statesman. What's a statesman?
Yeah, statesman, just another word really for a politician, but a bit more elevated, a bit more perhaps respectful term than politician. Politician can sometimes have a negative connotation to it. A statesman is someone who is involved in affairs of state, in affairs of governing a country or a state in the country, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it tends to have a positive connotation, and it often is used for people who we think of as having built a better system in one way or another. So they're sort of constructing a system. We also use it a lot for people who work between countries. So diplomats often get called statesmen, things like that. Okay, so Winston Churchill, he served as Prime Minister, which of course is the British or Commonwealth version of a president during World War II. And it gives us this situation. It lays out for us how he's, you know, speaking at some sort of university or something, and an American student asks him a question. What does the student ask, Peter?
Well, the student asks Churchill how to become a successful leader. And one can imagine that he might also be thinking how to become a successful statesman, since statesmen and women are leaders of states, as we've said. And Churchill's advice, and this is my bad Churchill impression, study history. Study history. In history lie all the secrets of statecraft.
It was not bad, Peter. That was not bad. Sounded like a lot of the Churchill movies I have seen.
Yes. What, it's an impression of an impression.
What I will say about Churchill is one of the things he is particularly famous for among native English speakers is his quotes.
Yes.
He has a lot of witty, kind of funny, insightful quotes that are often used. So no doubt that's why he has been chosen here, not just because of his commentary on history, which is related to our topic for today, but because he said things in an interesting way that people remember. So here he's repeating, study history, study history. So he's emphasizing it. And then he says, in history lie all the secrets of statecraft. So everything you need to know about leading a country or interacting between countries, you can learn from the lessons of history, which is, you know, a lot like our history repeats or history rhymes kind of messages, right?
Very much so.
As we continued on, it said, Gavin argues. Now, remind me here, who is Gavin? Oh, it's a professor. I skipped that part. Gavin, Frank Gavin. He's from Johns Hopkins University, the School of Advanced International Studies, and the director of the Kissinger Center. Do you know who Kissinger is?
Yes, Henry Kissinger, United States Secretary of State in the late 1960s and early 1970s, mainly under President Richard Nixon. Very influential figure, a controversial figure, particularly with regard to American policy in the Vietnam War, but highly respected as a statesman. And
respected enough to have a school named after him
there you
at
go.
A famous university.
Yes.
Yeah. So there you go. Obviously, the association with that name, it is a historical name, but it is very clearly connected to statecraft, which is kind of the practice of statesmanship. So it's what statesmen do, right? Yeah.
Just like witchcraft is the practice of what witches do. Just to help you.
Are you drawing a connection between statecraft and witchcraft?
No, only on a verbal level.
A little commentary on your views of statecraft?
Only on a verbal level.
There you go. Okay, so Gavin, this professor, he basically has a take on the importance of studying history, meaning he has an opinion here. What is he thinking about this?
Right. Well, Gavin argues that studying history, fascinating in its own right, meaning for its own sake, apart from any other benefit it might have, studying history, fascinating in its own right, can also be exceptionally helpful to aspiring statesmen and stateswomen. Aspiring meaning something that you are trying to get to, trying to accomplish, trying to be successful in. Many years ago, I was an aspiring actor back in New York City before I came to Taipei. And so here we're talking about aspiring statesmen and stateswomen who Gavin argues could be helped by studying history.
There is an interesting note here about the statesmen and the stateswomen there. Most of our listeners will be familiar with sort of the move to make job titles gender neutral. Mm. So, for example, we moved away from firemen to firefighters. We moved away from policemen to police officers. We were moved away from, you know, waitresses and waiters to server, which can be either a man or a woman, right? Kind of a gender-neutral thing. It's interesting, though, that I had not noticed this, but we don't really say statesperson.
Yeah.
Right? And so it seems that the older kind of gender neutrality, meaning referring to both the male version and the female version as opposed to a neutral version, is still the norm for statespeople.
Yes, statesmen.
I suppose statespeople is too much like the people who live in the state.
That could be.
There's a lot of room for confusion there.
Yeah.
Anyway, kind of an interesting language note. Basically, continuing on, Gavin says that examining the past does not provide ironclad laws of human behavior or a clear blueprint for the future. Very quickly, ironclad means
absolutely secure, no mistakes. Unassailable, which means that you can't argue against it as it being a position or a case, ironclad proof, something that, you know, is just can't be undone.
So it's there's no flexibility in it.
No,
it's always going to be.
Well, also
true
the implication is that there's no errors in it. That it is absolutely solid, like iron. Or clad in iron, meaning wearing iron. Just means, something that is has no mistakes, cannot be changed or argued against.
Okay, so it says it isn't ironclad or a clear blueprint for the future. So
Right. The
ironclad laws, those are like rules. What is a blueprint?
Right. Well, a blueprint is, of course, just the design of a house or a building on a special kind of blue paper for the architects to show how the building is to be built, what the measurements of the rooms are, the dimensions of it, and so on and so forth.
So key to the blueprint is it doesn't tell you how to build it. It just tells
Correct.
You what it's supposed to look like when it's done.
Exactly. Here's what it would look like if it were a two-dimensional picture on a piece of paper.
Okay, so we're hearing here from Gavin that by studying history, you're not going to get a set of perfect rules and you're not going to get a perfect picture of what the final product should be. So just quickly, we mentioned those two idioms at the beginning, right? History repeats and history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Mm-hmm. Which one would you say Gavin agrees with?
Yes, he would probably agree more with the one about history not repeating but rhyming.
Yeah.
Because the idea of history repeats itself, although true as far as it goes, does not mean that studying history is some sort of crystal ball that lets you look into the future and see exactly what's going to happen.
Okay, but like that idiom about history rhyming, Gavin does maintain there is value in studying history, because as we read on, it says, however, if investigated carefully, history can help leaders better appreciate complexity, uncertainty, and ambiguity in public affairs. So very quickly, public affairs, it just means matters or issues, that's the affairs part, that are of concern to the broader public, right, or the entire country or the entire community, whatever it happens to be. But there's a list there, complexity, uncertainty, and ambiguity. Complexity means things are complicated, obviously. Uncertainty means they are not predetermined,
right,
certain, right? What's the ambiguity part?
Right. Ambiguity means that there's more than one way of looking at something. There's more than one meaning it could have. A word that means that is something that is unclear or confusing, not radically different from uncertainty, but ambiguity meaning uncertainty is sort of a more broad term about whether something is certain or not certain. But ambiguity means that it could be this or it could be that. It is something. It's not just sort of a vague mud or something, but it's ambiguous. It's maybe this way, maybe that way, maybe there's a third way of understanding.
Not clear.
Exactly.
It's not clear. Okay, so history helps you appreciate these things. It also, as we continue on, teaches leaders to ask hard questions, re-examine long-held assumptions. So think about things that we assume are true but might not be true. Appreciate irony and be modest or even humble about what they think they know. Now, presumably, that's because history is full of stories of disasters or unintended things happening, right? People sort of get feeling secure, like they know what's going on, they have a good plan, and then there's always a surprise. And so all of these attributes, like being humble and understanding ambiguity or flexibility, things like that, they all come out of this idea that history is full of surprises. And so even if you don't know what's going to happen because of your study of history, you know something's going to happen that's disruptive. And you can see examples of how to better deal with that or deal with that badly. I guess that's the idea. All right. As we continue on into our second reading, we're going to look at some real-world benefits of studying history. Let's get Campbell back in here to read the second one for us now.
Real-world benefits. Gavin believes the skills needed to understand history can translate into practical tools for aspiring statespeople to confront contemporary problems and craft future strategies. He argues that grappling with consequential or contested historical questions is strikingly similar to making critical choices about governance. A rigorous understanding of the past provides insights and tools that enable better choices in the present. This is especially true in the extraordinarily consequential worlds of statecraft and strategy. Gavin writes in his compelling new book, Thinking Historically, A Guide to Statecraft and Strategy. He adds, "It may seem obvious that we should employ history to improve decision-making, but it is rarely done. Gavin is the professor you always wanted. He's whip-smart, quick-witted, hugely interesting, deeply inquisitive, intellectually bold, and kind-hearted. An expert on nuclear policy and international finance, he has taught at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the University of Texas, and now at Johns Hopkins. Gavin's writing is nuanced and compelling. It's also fun, with serious analysis lightened by references to the Top Gun movies, Charlie Brown Christmas specials, and contentious family vacations to history-rich colonial Williamsburg and Harper's Ferry."
Okay, so it tells us here that Gavin, our professor again, believes the skills needed to understand history can translate into practical tools. So translate here, it doesn't really mean shift in language. What it means instead is shift the use. So for example, if you study history, you're going to have to learn skills. Now, I don't know about you, Peter. I know you have a much deeper history in the humanities than I do. I studied the sciences, and we, I will admit it, were prone to looking down our noses at, you know, the sad people studying other things. One of the main reasons for that was we felt secure in our scientific method. We had very clear rules and principles and guidelines for how to do our disciplines the right way. And that was not always immediately clear about other subject areas. But there is, of course, a historical method. Have you heard of this historical method?
I have heard of the historical method, but unfortunately, the area of humanities I specialized in college was theater arts.
Oh, well, so the historical method there.
No historical, more of a dramaturgical method.
There you go.
What is the historical method?
I'll be honest with you. I do not have a clear understanding of it, but what I do understand of it is it's basically like a set of guidelines for how one studies history. Like what kinds of evidence one should believe, what kinds of things one should discard, you know, how much evidence is enough evidence, how many different people have to write about something for you to take that as true, how do you know which opinion to believe, you know, things like that, basically guidelines for that sort of thing. And I think that's basically what we're talking about here in terms of the tools. So the skills students are going to learn, they're going to learn to like question things, think critically about things, look for criteria to determine, you know, what is true and what is not true. One example I can think of immediately is we talk about primary and secondary sources. This we talk about in English literature as well. Basically, the idea being if a person was there and they saw it and they're writing about the thing that happened, they're probably more reliable than a person who read things or talked to people who saw it, but didn't see it themselves and then is also writing about it. So just guidelines, rules like that. That kind of thing can be useful if you can use it. Basically for people who want to be dealing with statecraft. Now, they use a lot of sentence there to say that. Aspiring statespeople. Well, we just said we don't usually say statespeople, but apparently we do now. The language is evolving while we are here on the island, as it turns out. So we do say statespeople now, in addition to statesmen and stateswomen, as it turns out, to confront contemporary problems and craft future strategies. So basically to work out a policy. Right.
Yeah. And he summarizes it nicely in the next sentence there. He, Gavin, argues that grappling with consequential or contested historical questions is strikingly similar to making critical choices about governance. A couple of vocab words there. Grappling just means to wrestle with, to struggle with. Consequential or contested historical questions, something that is contested. It's not, well, it is kind of like a contest in which, you know, there's a winner of some sort. Something that is contested means something that is not completely agreed upon, still argued about. It is a contested issue as to whether A happened or B happened. So obviously there's many historical questions that are contested. And that the act of grappling with those contested historical questions is strikingly similar. It means similar, but not just similar, but so similar that it's like being struck in the face, how similar it is. It is strikingly similar to making critical choices about governance, about running a state.
So what we're basically talking about here is when you've read a lot of history and you've seen things that happen and you come to understand why they happened, it kind of gives you like an SOP, a standard operating procedure for developing good ways of governing in the future. I can think of an example of that. When I was in teachers' college, I was introduced to this idea that if you want to build stability in a system, You have to let the people who are most affected by policies and decisions have the most say in creating the policies and decisions.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So the idea being, like, if you're the leader but you don't actually do the job and you develop a bunch of rules for how the people who do the job have to do the job, it may not work well. Like, you may be creating more work for them or creating systems that don't work well for them, and that creates instability. So people quit or they become unhappy or whatever. Whereas if you have them come up with the rules and the policies, and then it's sort of reviewed and approved by other people, you create a lot more stability in the system. Things work much more smoothly. So
that would seem well.
You know, it's like a rule of thumb for how you might approach this. And I think that's basically an example of what we're being told here. Now, Peter, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is the next paragraph there is largely a restatement of these ideas. So they're saying, like, having a good understanding, a rigorous understanding of the past gives you insights and skills and tools to make better choices in the present now, which kind of fits with your idiom about the past not really being the past, right?
Right, not being dead. In fact, it's not even past.
It has an influence on the future. So Gavin continues on by writing in his new book, which is called Thinking Historically, A Guide to Statecraft and Strategy. It may seem obvious that we should employ history to improve decision-making, but it is rarely done. So this is kind of common knowledge, common understanding, but we don't always do it. And I gather that's the point of the book. Now, going into our last paragraph there, Peter, it tells us that this professor is a great guy.
Yeah,
tell us a little bit about him.
I love this paragraph. Gavin is the professor you always wanted when you were back in college or graduate school. He's the professor that maybe you didn't have, but you always wanted. He's whip smart, which means smart, very smart, being able to understand quickly. Quick-witted means, you know, easily makes jokes, smart, intelligent jokes, hugely interesting.
Inquisitive, which means he asks interesting questions, right?
Right. He's interested in the world around him.
And he's intellectually bold and kind-hearted, all good things. He's an expert on nuclear policy and international finance, different kind of topics there. And he's taught at a number of places. So they list MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the University of Texas, and now he's at Johns Hopkins. His writing is nuanced, meaning it's full of interesting detail and understanding. It's also compelling, which means it's good to read. It's fun, with serious analysis lightened by references to Top Gun movies and things like that. And basically, contentious family vacations. So I guess he's telling personal stories there about, like, fighting with the family on trips to historical sites.
Contentious, yeah, a word that just means causing a lot of argument, disagreement between people, something that people fight over. Like, you know, where do we go for lunch? Where do we go for dinner? Who gets which room in the hotel? Something like that.
Now, listeners, we're out of time for today, but we're going to continue with this lesson tomorrow. I'm hoping Peter will be back. And so we will be here just as we were today, tomorrow. Until then, I'm Simon.
I'm Peter.
Saying bye for now.
Bye-bye.